there is a lot of hand-wringing of like, oh, like, it's not, if we make them awesome, they're going to leave, or like, it's not our responsibility to make you awesome. But I think in reality, if you make other people awesome, you're going to stumble into being awesome.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Wenham. Today, I'm joined by Miles Sterrett. Miles is a partner at Fretless, a custom software development shop that helps high-growth teams level up their software development chops. Miles has been the interim engineering leader for three VC-backed startups. He helps them overcome technical debt and build the engineering team that hits their product goals. In this episode, we talk about hiring a cohort of bootcamp grads and helping them be more effective by delivering targeted feedback. And now, here's my conversation with Miles Sterrett. Miles Sterrett, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Wes. I'm stoked to be here. I'm ready to rock.
What brought you into engineering leadership?
Well, so I have, for about as long as I can remember, as our mutual friend Tyler Moore would put it, been a person who starts things. And a more like recent example would be, you know, just getting into IndieRB and taking over leadership roles there and starting Indie Hackers and that sort of thing. But it really dates back to high school. Once I realized that's a thing that I like to do, I took over management when my then manager left Endframe in 2010. That went okay. But really, you know, fast forward a bit, I freelanced for a few years after that and ended up starting Fretless with my former manager at Endframe, Davey Struess. And that's where I started kind of more deep diving on engineering management as a craft and that sort of thing.
So Davey left, you became the manager, and then you followed Davey into Fretless. Is that the right people?
Yeah, something like that. So I had been freelancing for a couple years, and Davey, when he left Endframe, he was enterprise IT manager, was the official title at Indiana University. And so when I realized that, this goes along with being a person who starts these little communities, right? When I realized that like freelancing means you're a lone wolf, and I actually don't enjoy being a lone wolf, I texted Davey and said, hey, what if we started a thing? Like, where are you at as far as enterprise IT manager goes at IU? And he was like, yeah, can we start tomorrow? Like, I'm ready. But yeah, so then as part of Fretless, you know, I've been kind of able to further hone that craft. And I think it's a, you know, like, I will probably never feel like I'm super great at it, perhaps, but I've been able to, you know, be interim director at places like Springbuck and Peerview Data and now Olio. So it's been fun.
So those are startups at kind of different places on the spectrum. I'd love to zoom back. You said things went okay when you kind of got thrust into that engineering management. What are some of the okayer parts of that? What did you learn that you wish past Miles would have known about engineering management?
I would say that I took a decidedly project manager style tactic, I guess. There's, you know, project management tactics instead of really engineering management. And so it went okay. it was just me and one other person. The good and bad there is that only one person had to suffer at the hands of possibly poor engineering management. But he seems to still like me and works for Fretless now, so it's okay.
That's a pretty good sign. So you're jumping around. So Springbuck is kind of Series B startup, and then you've got Peerview, which is earlier, Olio, that's earlier. You're kind of being an interim VP of engineering. I don't know if that's the title, but that's my perception. What is not so awesome about that?
I don't want to sound like a complainer because there's lots of aspects that I love about this and about jumping all over the place. But being a manager or a director of engineering or what have you at a client, as well as more or less that thing for Fretless at the same time, to the best of my abilities, can be really stressful. You know, we kind of have a belief at Fretless that we need to be at least on par, if not better, than your best employee in whatever role we're fulfilling, or else what's the point of having Fretless there? And it is. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to have a partner at Fretless in Davey Struess, or otherwise I would probably have a complete meltdown. But no, it's good. It's good pressure. It makes you grow and that sort of thing. So there's positives and negatives, but that's probably the most difficult part.
So you have to be the best version, the best engineering manager. That's kind of the pressure you put on yourself. How do you deal with that stress? It sounds like having a partner that you can talk to helps. What are some other techniques you've used to be more resilient?
Yeah, I think, we'll say letting myself play. You've had some previous guests on the podcast kind of talk about things like that, like not putting yourself under the pressure of also reading, you know, engineering management articles all night. You've had folks talk about getting enough sleep. I won't claim to be great at the sleep thing. I have the tendency to go the other direction and decide like, oh, like this book that I'm reading right now, this fantasy fiction book, which tends to be my pleasure, guilty pleasure, depending on your perception of that thing. Let's just read this until midnight and then get up at 6 or 6:30 or whatever, which obviously is not sustainable for a long time. But it also helps me evade some of that burnout that I think you can get by keeping yourself under that constant pressure to get better and be the best at engineering management or whatever your craft is.
So let yourself read friction and just kind of get lost is a technique that works pretty well for you, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about, you've had some interesting roles mentoring group of code school graduations. Could you kind of set the stage on what that was like? I'd love to learn more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have done that in a few different ways. So at a company called Mobi, now part of Tango, I ran a 3-month, what we called an apprenticeship program, or I co-ran this program with one of their employees. We had 5 people in kind of all new to development from kind of various backgrounds, but 2 of them fresh from a code school called the Iron Yard. And then, you know, there's been various, I guess, code school grads that I've worked with either as being a senior developer or as being the director of engineering at various places, including my current client, Olio, and including Fretless, actually. So we've had a couple code school grads.
You've done this several times now where you've mentored a group of junior engineers. What have you learned about how to do that successfully?
I think what I've learned the most is that when you graduate from a code school, especially some of these immersive, you know, quit your job and do this full time for 3+ months sort of code schools, you come out of that accustomed to drinking from the fire hose, as impossible as that might sound. And that can be awesome for your manager or what have you, because you are constantly thirsting for knowledge. And so they can just, you know, feed you as much knowledge as possible, and you'll still be able to, they'll still be able to take on more. It can also be somewhat intimidating as the person trying to feed them knowledge, because you never have enough. They're always seeking more. But it's great. So they can, I feel like coming from a code school, you're so accustomed to learning so fast that you come on the job and pick things up super quick. And of course, there's always going to be gaps in knowledge. You're a brand new developer. And probably if your employer is bringing you on out of a code school, they know that. Hopefully they are prepared then to help you fill in some of those gaps that, you know, maybe someone from some other background would already have that filled or what have you.
So when you're at a startup and you have product to ship, you know, there's a roadmap, there's customers, there's cash, drop dead dates. How have you balanced that, those knowledge gaps, with the need to ship?
Some of it is just making sure you're putting those people kind of in a position to succeed. You know, whether that's a task that you're confident they can quickly figure out on their own, or whether it's pairing with, you know, starting off by pairing with someone else, or that sort of thing. I think in a lot of cases, hiring a code school grad, you don't hire a code school grad in order to further push your pedal towards the metal. You hire a code school grad as fuel for 100 miles down the road when you're going to need it, if that makes any sense. This is an off the cuff analogy that may turn out terrible.
I like it. So we're talking about a trade-off between the short term and maybe medium term, effectively. It helps you go farther in the medium term.
A lot of times what you're getting from a code school grad is someone who had a previous career. And so they have experience they can bring to bear that someone fresh out of college doesn't have. And a lot of times, and I think a huge advantage of looking at code school grads, is they could have experience in an area that required a lot of practice communicating with other people. That is not always a thing that a lot of technical people get, is that practice communicating with other people. And I think nearly everyone that you've had on this podcast, nearly everyone that you would probably ask about what's important when you're hiring someone for an engineering role would say, oh, communication is super important, right? And that's, so I think that's a big advantage of a code school graduate.
When, given that trade-off between the go far and the push the pedal to the metal, and you've been at this at several different stages of companies when they've made this decision to hire a group of code school grads, what is the time where, if I'm considering, all right, I got this much budget, I got to hire senior engineers, mid-level engineers, I could do something like this. When is the right time, or what would I consider to decide when I want to hire a group of code school grads? When's the right time?
I think that is a super, super difficult question. It's perhaps going to be different, a different answer for everyone. For me, I think you should at least consider in your hiring process bringing on a code school grad or I like the term early career developer as opposed to junior developer. Bringing on an early career developer when you have at least a couple, you know, senior level engineers that are willing and able to mentor. What I like to do is, and now I've mostly hired for smaller teams and mostly hired for, we'll say, single teams that are maybe on the cusp of splitting into 2 to 3 teams, that sort of thing. So as a caveat of sorts, but I like to put out job posts that are pretty general and that don't necessarily say, I need a senior, or I need a mid-level, or I need an early career developer. Talk more about your company and, you know, what your company does and what the business domain is and what it's like for an engineer at that company, and then see what you get. And sometimes you get a candidate that is so great in all of the areas except for this technical area that we measure by, you know, early career, mid, and senior. And it could be worth taking a chance. And you have to ask yourself at that point, like, can I do this? Do I have the capacity? Do I have the senior level leadership to support this person and grow them into the, you know, amazing engineer that I think they're going to become in a couple years?
So I need to have at least a couple senior engineers who are ready and willing, and then they need to decide if I'm willing to make that investment to grow that person into what they can become. What's some advice? Let's say I was hiring you to coach a group of early career developers. What's something that you would do different now taking on that task versus maybe what you did when you did it for the first time? What's something you've learned?
What I would tell past Miles is practice giving negative feedback. You want to give more positive than negative. You don't want to do them at exactly the same time. The classic, like, sandwich.
Turd sandwich. Thing. Yeah.
Oh, it's terrible. Don't do that. But I tell people this all the time. I tell people this in my, like, hi, I'm going to be your engineering manager. Here's how I do things. I am constantly trying to get better at giving negative feedback. I don't like doing it. Feels bad. I'm the guy who likes to just, you know, give everybody a high five every day and say how great everything is all the time. That makes me feel good, makes other people feel good, which makes me feel good. But people will struggle to get better and to correct their mistakes if they're not being told what they're not doing great or what their mistakes are. And so I would tell past Miles, practice that. Practice giving negative feedback. Give negative feedback as close to the moment that the negative thing happened as possible, and do that regularly. And I think regularly for me would still probably not be often enough because of my hang-ups about that thing. But I would help a lot of people get a lot better in that way, I think.
So an important bit is timeliness, giving the feedback near to when the thing that could have been improved happens. What else makes negative feedback more effective?
There's I think Manager Tools podcast talks about this, and I'm probably going to mess it up, but make it very concise, which as your listeners will find, I am not that thing.
Concise is hard.
Yeah,
I didn't have really time hard to write you a short letter, so I've written you this long podcast.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, you say, essentially, first you got to ask It's important to ask and make sure they're open to feedback at that moment. If you just walk up and tap somebody on the shoulder, they were in the zone, they turn around and they're angry at you, and then you give them negative feedback, which I've totally had that happen, and it's like feels bad on top of feels bad, and then that person maybe just wants to go home for the day. You have to ask, make sure they're open to feedback at that moment, and make them understand, hopefully you've talked to them previously about how you want to give feedback, and they understand that if they're just not ready for that, they can say no hard feelings. And then you let them know, like, hey, when you do X, it has Y negative effect, so let's try to correct that behavior, or whatever sort of very brief corrective suggestion, you might have, and then let it go. Like, then you're done. Walk away. Unless they seem to not understand or have questions or that sort of thing, but keep it that short and then move on. It's so hard though, Wes. It's so hard.
It is. You want to caveat, you want to say, but you're doing so great at other things. And
yeah,
I think it dilutes the feedback.
Oh man. Yep. Anyway, that is, that helps everyone, but the early career developer, the out of code school developer, needs that, maybe more than anyone. And it's probably going to be more receptive to it than anyone. They are in a new career and they want to be, they wouldn't have spent the money and time to go to code school if they didn't want to be as good as possible at this thing. I mean, that is a commitment that they have made to themselves. And so you're helping them if you give them that negative feedback.
Would you be up for role playing some negative feedback with me? I read Max Yoder's Do Better workbook, and now I'm super jazzed on the idea of, like, let's try some conversations as a way to learn, get more concrete.
Okay.
Would you be up for that?
Yes. Yeah. Right. Let's try it.
let's do it. Okay. So I'm a junior developer. What's a thing that a common mistake you see early on that I might have made? Maybe I break the build.
Yeah.
What do? I push code without getting review.
Yep. Yeah. Now I'm trying to think of a thing where the type of thing, actually, you know what a really good one is that I think that everybody can get this feedback or needs to get this feedback early is the scenario where you've started to feel a little bit confident about maybe one area of the code, and you jump in on a code review and drop a, this is a terrible idea, or something along those lines in a text, and maybe the person to whom you responded, if you said that to them in person, in your jovial manner, they'd be like, ha, 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 and everybody would move on with their lives. But that is one of the toughest ones, and one I have, as I was racking my brain, I have confronted that before and failed to give the negative feedback. And that's one that festers pretty quickly.
All right, let's try it. So I'm heads down, I'm coding. I read a pull request earlier today, one of my colleagues. I was feeling pretty confident. This is a terrible idea. You should redo this.
Hey, Wes, do you have a moment for me to just give you a little bit of feedback?
Yeah. Sure, Miles, what's up?
Great. So I was looking at your review of, Tyler's pull request, and when in a pull request, you kind of come with a lot of negativity and say, this is a terrible idea, it immediately puts the other person on the defensive and makes it difficult to have a constructive discussion about the code and about why it might not be the best idea. So if next time, if you can just kind of try to find a way to phrase it as constructively as possible, that would really help us have good conversations about the code. Does that make sense?
Constructively, it was kind of a terrible idea. He was repeating whole sections of his code. What would I be looking? How do I make that constructive?
Yeah, so maybe just you can say, "Hey, it looks like we've got some repetition in here. Maybe we can extract out some methods or something to reduce the repetition and make this code easier to understand and change in the future." That might be an example, I think, of how you could say it in a way where Tyler's not gonna feel hurt.
That was awesome. I don't, listeners, if this was super annoying or super interesting, let us know. I like role playing, so we might do it again if nobody hates it. Thanks for walking through that with me, Miles.
Yeah. Hopefully that worked out all right.
That Tyler, duplicating code all the time. What is something regarding software engineering leadership that you've changed your mind on?
Yeah, no, this is a good one. That a good team doesn't need hands-on management. I think I was in pretty good company regarding this belief. I think probably a lot of folks still believe it. But, you know, you're starting to see some organizations that kind of seem to lean on this belief and had a very flat structure start to create more of a leadership hierarchy.
More pointy-haired bosses, right?
Yeah, right. And, you know, like, there's the, and this is still a thing, and I totally get it. You know, with more leadership hierarchy comes more meetings, and meetings seem to be universally despised. And that's a whole other probably conversation that we could really dig into. But
so what changed your mind? What made you come to this realization that maybe hands-on engineering leadership was beneficial to the team?
Certainly a lot of different things, but there's one inflection point, I guess, or one kind of set of events that really cemented it for me. And a few years ago, at least Fretless, we had 5 developers. We were humming along. It was awesome. We felt awesome. And within the span of about 6 months, we lost 2 of them, which is, you know, 40%. So it felt pretty significant to us. And we're still friends with those folks. Love them. Great folks, but they left for somewhat similar reasons. And I cannot help but wonder if I had been having regular one-on-ones and having conversations with them to better understand very early on kind of where their head's at on, for instance, consulting lifestyle versus product engineering team lifestyle, that sort of thing, or any, you know, number of other problems that could occur with an engineering team. If we were talking about those 6 months before they left, would they have left at that time? Would we have had them longer? Would they still be here today? Would I have been able to just, you know, help? Or if nothing else, if I had known earlier, maybe we could have made the transition smoother for everyone involved, right? So even things like that, like, listen, it's software engineering. People are going to leave jobs probably around every 18 months at this point, right? You jump in and do your tour of duty, essentially, and then you move on to the next thing. But that doesn't mean that that thing can't be done better. That whole transition, that whole sort of professional development and then transition elsewhere.
Yeah, losing team members is tough. I think the best managers can help people become professionally fulfilled. I think that's a good usage of 101. Maybe that's not the average, but I think that's definitely possible. Thinking about being professionally fulfilled, what responsibility do you think companies have towards professional development for their team members?
I think at least some, if not quite a bit. Listen, I get it. The benefit of professional development to an employee is obvious. So we just talk about like the risks for the employer, which I think is what most people worry about. You know, if I put a bunch of time into this employee, they're going to leave in 18 months, right? And yeah, maybe they will. They're going to go and take their big full brain elsewhere. And then that big full brain is going to go be super productive somewhere else. And if you do things right, they're going to say how awesome it was that your company helped them get to their brain big and full. Other people are going to notice how big and full their brain is and be impressed, you know. Or they might not leave, and they might use their big full brain to make your company's work more awesome, thereby making you more awesome, and then everybody wins. So, like, I feel like there is a lot of hand-wringing of, like, oh, like, it's not, you know, if we make them awesome, they're going to leave, or, like, it's not our responsibility to make you awesome. But I think in reality, if you make other people awesome, you're going to stumble into being awesome. So just make other people awesome.
The awesome osmosis property. Help people be awesome and it'll rub off. I know one local company, and local being Indianapolis, Miles and I are both live in Indianapolis, that they went to a conference and one of their team members used that conference to apply to other jobs and to do interviews. And then they came away with a policy to not sponsor conferences in the future because they didn't want that to happen again. So let's say you're the engineering manager there. Let's say you're pointy-haired boss. as a pointy-haired boss, I can say that is pushing back and saying, why would I send my team to a conference when I might just lose them? How do you advocate for that professional development?
I think that's the exception. I think you could probably dig up a ton of stories that are, you know, we went to this conference and talked to a bunch of people and we ended up, you know, well, for the other company, their story is they hired this awesome person at that conference, right?
That's right. there's a certain symmetry to that.
But in my experience and with conferences in particular, like, you send your people, they are stoked the opportunity to get to go to that conference without, you know, spending a copious amount of their own dime and going on vacation. They learn a ton. If you send multiple members of your team, they get to bond and discuss and further grow one another through going to those conference talks and that sort of thing. There is a possibility that someone's going to go talk to other people and apply elsewhere. But if they were going to go there and apply elsewhere and it happened to be there, they were going to apply elsewhere anyway. They just happened to use that.
That counterfactual. It was going to happen either way. So why try to hold it down?
There's a similar story for a company that I used to work for where they got lots of certifications for people, not software engineering, but network operations and that sort of thing. And to a great extent, they required those certifications. Like, every year you needed to kind of add to the list of acronyms at the end of your name if you were going to work in this department. There was a couple people who, over the course of 6 months, got three different certifications paid for by the company and then used their new certification to jump to a higher paying job elsewhere. And so they similarly made the policy that if you left within like 6 months of getting a certification, you had to pay back the cost of that certification. But I don't get it. I mean, that's a good way to kind of double punish yourself if you weren't willing to give that person a promotion for the new certifications, which is probably the reason, you know, they were looking elsewhere. And then in the future, you're going to charge people if they try to, you know, kind of gain that promotion through the job jump. Man, that's going to get out there. People are going to hear about that. And then that's going to make your whole recruiting and hiring process more difficult. Not to mention that maybe you're going to make people think twice about trying to make their brains bigger and fuller while still working for you.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. Miles built the ability for his team to go far together by hiring great junior engineers and mentoring them. Hiring junior engineers presents unique challenges. We consistently see junior titles with 10 to 20 times the candidate volume compared to senior titles. And with early career engineers, resumes have a lower to signal to noise ratio. There's less signal. Each resume looks mostly the same. The good news is that there are great fit developers in that pool of resumes. Those folks are also very willing to spend time to show what they can do. In the last few weeks, we ran nearly 100 junior engineers through a work simulation for one single customer. All of those folks got detailed feedback, and a handful of them are ready for the next step. We found a college senior with amazing communication and troubleshooting results. He was on par with one of our customers' senior engineers. This is someone still in college. At Woven, the first thing we do with our customers is 3 to 5x their inbound candidate volume. We just took a customer from 50 to 60 candidates per week. It's not magic. It's just a checklist of things that make a big difference in job board marketing. Today, I'm offering that inbound sourcing review for free to listeners of our podcast. You can go to woventeams.com/free to schedule with me. Again, if you want to 3x your inbound candidate flow, go to woventeams.com/free.
So I'm glad you mentioned recruiting and hiring. What's a hiring or mentoring mistake that you've made in the past?
Mentoring-wise, I think the easiest mistake to make is kind of giving the mentee maybe even more credit for knowledge that they have than they would maybe say they want. So as a better, more illustrative example, I feel like I've worked with a lot of really smart people from code schools, and they're so smart that sometimes I forget that there is one whole piece of, you know, software engineering that they have had zero exposure to. And so I might say, well, yeah, just if you could just go and write a couple unit tests for that, that'd be great. You know, probably these three public methods need some unit tests. And then, yeah, I think this story's ready to go. And because you kind of acted like that should be a thing they already know how to do, and they could just go and kind of whip that up, they might just kind of look at you and, okay, yeah, I'll do that then.
I'll just go write unit tests. Like that, yep. That word just is...
Oh, yeah. The anchor words.
It's a dangerous word.
The anchor words. Actually, at when I was at Mobi, now Tango, I should probably just call them Tango because that's what they do now. But for me, it's Mobi, now Tango.
The artist formerly known as...
Yeah, exactly. They would, when you were talking about code or about in a code review or... If you were reviewing, you know, stories for the next sprint or that sort of thing, if you used something like just, or if you said that should be easy, if you used any sort of anchor word when talking about the thing, they would write that anchor word on the board and write your name next to it. And it's essentially as a, like, in-meeting shame in order to try to break people of the tendency to use those terms. I always kind of appreciated that.
What are some other anchor words? Just is one. Easy is work. That should be easy. That's an anchor.
There's one that has cropped up for me recently. It's become our go-to joke phrase because it is an attempt to avoid anchor words and just turn them into a longer phrase is what has happened. And it is that should be regular or that should be relatively straightforward, right?
Should be relatively
straightforward.
Yeah, just. Go build a startup and raise venture capital. That should be relatively straightforward.
Yeah. I mean, many people have done it, right?
It's all relatively straightforward. What role do soft skills like communication and collaboration have in your interview process?
A very large role. I would say those are the main focus of the sort of hiring and interviewing process for me.
And how do you get a read on those?
That... is a longer answer.
That should be relatively straightforward, right?
Yeah, it's relatively straightforward. No, that's actually the opposite of the case. It's arguably, I suppose, but it's relatively straightforward, perhaps, to figure out technical ability. Because at least technical ability, you know, it's technical in nature. I mean, it's at least somewhat quantifiable. Communication skills and collaborative skills, teamwork, all of those things
can be fuzzier.
Very fuzzy. All of the fuzzy. So first of all, you have to establish some sort of rubric. It's not easy. But as you've said in a previous episode, which I really enjoyed, an imperfect rubric is better than no rubric at all. So I have a pretty imperfect rubric, for these things, or, I guess a way to fashion that thing. I've had a lot of help getting to kind of my process today, including from you fine woven folks. Lots of advice and all of that sort of stuff, which I really appreciate. But so at least today, and it evolves all the time, right? Like I try to start with a list of outcomes that I would expect in, you know, the first 30, 60, and 90 days from a sort of a successful hire. So just kind of assume that you made the right hire and then they did, you know, these things.
What's an outcome that would be kind of communication, collaboration leaning?
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. I'm going to refrain from just quickly digging into my Google Drive for all of the documents that I have on that sort of thing. So actually one that I really like is I probably phrase it in a better way because I sat and thought about it a long time in my actual document, but something along the lines of, disagreed with me kind of publicly in a meeting. And I would understand if people would think that sounds funny, but I want people to push back and I want people to speak up in meetings and tell me when they think something is a terrible idea, as we talked about earlier, preferably in a more constructive way. Although, you know, that happens sometimes too, and that's all right, because I have lots of terrible ideas all the time. And
me too.
We can't make the best whatever it is that we're making if everybody just rolls with my terrible ideas because I have roll power, right? And I need people to push back.
So you've got objective, disagree with Miles in a meeting. So that's your objective. How do you get at that, get at their likelihood of achieving that objective?
So, you know, looking at that and some of the other outcomes we might come up with, try to create a competency. So kind of a word or phrase that embodies whatever that attitude is, which I can't think of what exactly you would call this tells Miles he's bad at stuff, competency.
Confidence to disagree. Openness to giving feedback. I don't know what I'd call that, but I think I have the idea in my head. I can imagine that.
Yeah. I guess, Wes, I need people who are better at negative feedback than I am around.
We all do.
So then from there, you can take that and start to gather however it is that you might gather behavioral interview style questions that you believe will lead to sort of a positive or negative answer about those competencies.
I mean, what's a behavioral style question?
So honestly, on this one, it might be, hey, tell me about a time that you disagreed with one of your leaders about a product direction suggestion.
I told him on a pull request that his idea was terrible.
Right. And so at that point, actually what you find out is maybe they have the competency of willing to disagree. Maybe they lack the competency of gives constructive feedback. or something like that, right? And so then you can kind of craft a rubric and cite supporting evidence from your interview with competency and you know, stories, behavioral interview stories or answers that kind of point to those things, confirm or refute those competencies.
I love that lens of gathering evidence. That I'm going to repeat that tying. We've got an objective, which is disagrees with Miles in a meeting during the first 30 days. And then we've got a competency, which we couldn't define. Maybe there's willingness to disagree and ability to do so constructively. Maybe those are two competencies. And then we have a behavioral interview question. They tell me about a time where someone exhibited those competencies, and that helps us predict whether they're going to meet that objective. It's simple, but it's powerful. It's not technical. It's not fancy. It's asking questions in Google Docs, I presume. That's what we use.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you can get, you know, you can dive deep on that and start doing things like, well, these competencies are tier one competencies and, you know, so they're most important, and kind of try to poke at that. Like, where is the line of hire, don't hire, which I think is super difficult.
That is a difficult line. That is the line we're all trying to figure out. That's my journey.
Right. Yeah.
My guest today has been Miles Starrett. Miles, thank you so much for being on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes. It was a good time.
Thanks again to Miles for sharing his experience with us. Here are my lessons learned. Number one, great communicators come from code schools. Miles has had great success at mentoring junior engineers, including engineers out of coding boot camps. While some hiring managers are concerned about a potential lack of technical skill from boot camps, Miles sees it differently. We all believe that effective communication is essential to success. He has observed that many boot camp grads have strong communication skills because they've had previous career experience. They've done non-technical roles. They've worked with people. If we are struggling to find communicators, we should consider giving coding bootcamp folks another look. Number two, negative feedback is essential for coaching early career engineers. Giving negative feedback is really hard. It can feel bad. Nobody likes to deliver the bad news. But when we avoid it, our team suffers. This is especially true with junior engineers. Miles borrowed a framework from the Manager Tools podcast that works well for him. The framework is, when you do X, that impacts Y. Next time, could you do Z instead? We'll link to the Manager Tools podcast in the show notes. Number three, one-on-ones can help us avoid team churn. Early in his career, Miles wasn't even sure that managers were necessary. He has since changed his tune. He's seen team churn that he believes could have been avoided if he had kept with one-on-ones. Today, he uses regular weekly one-on-ones to keep an active pulse on his team. This helps him know when turnover risk may exist
so we can proactively work to avoid them. If we know when people are in trouble, we have a chance to make a difference. Thanks again to Miles for coming on the show. Now, I want to hear from you. Did you find the negative feedback roleplay useful? Tweet me at Wes Winner. Thanks, and I'll talk to you again next week.